President Kennedy's last 24 hours began shortly after high noon on Thursday, November 21st, 1963, in the historic city of the Alamo, San Antonio. It began when the giant superjet of the president, Air Force One, first touched Texas soil. It was destined to be a historic day from the very beginning. It was the first time any president had been accompanied by his wife on a visit to Texas. It was the first time Mrs. Kennedy had ever accompanied her husband on a tour. It was the first public appearance of the First Lady since the death of her infant son a few months earlier. And Texans, led by their governor John Connally and his charming wife Nellie, were on hand by the thousands to greet their president and his wife, and to welcome home Vice President and Mrs. Johnson. Thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands, lined the long parade route in San Antonio. Their faces glowed with friendliness, happiness. Their cheers were enthusiastic. At last, the president's party reached the Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine at Brooks Medical Center, where Mr. Kennedy dedicated a vast new complex of buildings at an outdoor meeting.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, Governor, Mr. Vice President, Senator, members of the Congress, members of the military, ladies and gentlemen. For more than 3 years, I've spoken about the new frontier. This is not a partisan term, and it's not the exclusive property of Republicans or Democrats. It refers instead to this nation's place in history, to the fact that we do stand on the edge of a great new era, filled with both crisis and opportunity, an era to be characterized by achievement, and by challenge. It is an area which calls for action and for the best efforts of all those who would test the unknown and the uncertain in every phase of human endeavor. It is a time for pathfinders and pioneers. I have come to Texas today to salute an outstanding group of pioneers, the men who manned the Brooks Air Force Base School of Aerospace Medicine and the Aerospace Medical Center. It is fitting that San Antonio should be the site of this center and this school as we gather to dedicate this complex of buildings. For this city has long been the home of the pioneers in the air. It was here that Sidney Brooks, whose memory we honor today, was born and raised. It was here that Charles Lindbergh and Claire Chennault, and a host of others who in World War I and World War II and Korea, and even today, have helped demonstrate American mastery of the skies, trained at Kelly Field and Randolph Field, which form a major part of aviation history. And in the new frontier of outer space, while headlines may be made by others in other places, history is being made every day by the men and women of the Aerospace Medical Center, without whom there could be no history. Many Americans make the mistake of assuming that space research has no values here on Earth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Just as the wartime development of radar gave us the transistor and all that it made possible, so research in space medicine holds the promise of substantial benefit to those of us who are earthbound. For our effort in space is not, as some have suggested, a competitor for the natural resources that we need to develop the Earth. It is a working partner and a co-producer of these resources. And nothing makes this clearer than the fact that medicine in space going to make our lives healthier and happier here on Earth. I give you three examples. First, medical space research may open up new understandings of man's relation to his environment. Examination of the astronaut's physical and mental and emotional reactions can teach us more about the differences between normal and abnormal, about the causes and effects of disorientation in metabolism, which could result in extending the lifespan. When you study effects on our astronauts of exhaust gases
which can contaminate their environment and seek ways to alter these gases so to reduce their toxicity. You're working in problems similar to those we face in our great urban centers, which themselves are being corrupted by gases and which must be cleared. And second, medical space research may revolutionize the technology and the techniques of modern medicine. Whatever new devices are created, for example, to monitor our astronauts, to measure their heart activity, their breathing, their brain waves, their eye motion, at great distances and under difficult conditions, will also represent a major advance in general medical instrumentation. Heart patients may even be able to wear a light monitor, which will sound a warning if their activity exceeds certain limits. An instrument recently developed to record automatically the impact of acceleration upon an astronaut's eyes will also be of help to small children who are suffering miserably from eye defects but are unable to describe their impairment. And also by the use of instruments similar to those used in Project Mercury, this nation's private as well as public nursing services are being improved, enabling one nurse now to give more critically ill patients greater attention than they ever could in the past. And third, medical space research may lead to new safeguards against hazards common to many environments. Specifically, our astronauts will need fundamentally new devices to protect them from the ill effects of radiation, which can have a profound influence upon medicine and man's relations to our present environment. Here at this center, we have the laboratories, the talent, the resources to give new impetus to vital research in the life centers. I'm not suggesting that the entire space program is justified alone by what is done in medicine. The space program stands on its own as a contribution to national strength. And last Saturday at Cape Canaveral, I saw our new Saturn C-1 rocket booster, which with its payload when it rises in December of this year will be for the first time the largest booster in the world, carrying into space the largest payload that any country in the world has ever sent into space. That's what I consider. I think the United States should be a leader. A country as rich and powerful as this, which bears so many burdens and responsibilities, which has so many opportunities, should be second to none. And in December, while I do not regard our mastery of space as anywhere near complete, while I recognize that there are still areas where we are behind, at least in one area, the size of the booster, this year I hope the United States will be ahead. And I'm for it. We have a long way to go, many weeks and months and years of long, tedious work lies ahead. There will be setbacks and frustrations and disappointments. There will be, as there always are, pressures on this country to do less in this area as in so many others, and temptations to do something else that's perhaps easier. But this research here must go on. This space effort must go on. The conquest of space must and will go ahead. That much we know. That much we can say with confidence and conviction. Frank O'Connor, the Irish writer, tells in one of his books, How as a Boy, he and his friends would make their way across the countryside. And when they came to an orchard wall that seemed too high and too doubtful to try, and too difficult to permit their voyage to continue, they took off their hats and tossed them over the wall, and then they had no choice but to follow them. This nation has tossed its cap over the wall of space, and we have no choice but to follow it. Whatever the difficulties, they will be overcome. Whatever the hazards, they must be guarded against. with the vital help of this aerospace medical center, with the help of all those who labor in the space endeavor, with the help and support of all Americans, we will climb this wall with safety and with speed, and we shall then explore the wonders on the other side. Thank you.
From San Antonio, the giant blue and white presidential jet lifted its wings for Houston, where an even larger crowd awaited Mr. and Mrs. Kennedy. At the height of the afternoon crush, traffic on the Gulf Freeway near the airport was at a standstill as eager Texans parked their cars on the superhighway, climbed on top for a better look at the president and his lady as they rode into town. Before the main event of the night, President and Mrs. Kennedy paid a short visit to a meeting of the League of United Latin American Citizens, where the First Lady thrilled her audience by addressing them in Spanish. Later that evening, President Kennedy spoke to an overflow crowd in the Sam Houston Coliseum at a testimonial dinner for veteran Congressman Albert Thomas.
Congressman and Mrs. Thomas, Mr. Vice President, Governor Connally, Senator Yarbrough, Congressman Casey and the Congressional Delegation of Texas, ladies and gentlemen, when I came to the House of Representatives in 1947, as a fairly young congressman from Massachusetts, I heard the old saying that you spend the first 6 months in the House of Representatives wondering how you got there, and the next 6 months wondering how everybody else got there. I spent the first 6 months as expected, but I must say that I never wondered how Congressman Thomas got there. It's always been clear to me. When I read the report that Congressman Thomas was thinking of resigning, I called him up on the phone and asked him to stay as long as I stayed. I didn't know how long that would be, but I wanted him to stay. I wanted him to stay because I thought that he not only represented this district with distinction, but also he served the United States. The presidency has been called a good many names, and presidents have been also, but no president can do anything without the help of friends. And I must say, in the 3 years that I've been in this office, the 3 years really since I was here in Houston that night in this hall, I don't know anyone who's been a greater help in trying to get the job done, not just for Houston and not just for Texas, but for the entire United States, and Albert Thomas. And I'm glad to be with his friends here tonight. He may not be so well known outside of this district in Texas and Washington, but I can tell you that when he rises to speak in the House of Representatives, they listen, so do some senators, and so do we down at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. He has one of the longest records of seniority in the Senate, in the House, one of the shortest biographies. He's been consistently loyal to his party, but he's always stayed above partisan rancor. His record serves his constituents, but it serves the United States. He has helped steer this country to its present eminence in space. Next month, when the United States of America fires the largest booster in the history of the world into space for the first time, giving us the lead, fires the largest payload into space, giving us the lead. It will be the largest payroll, too. And who should know that better than Houston? Put a little of it right in here. But in any case, the United States next month will have a leadership in space which you wouldn't have without Albert Thomas. And so will this city. He's been a stickler for efficiency in government, but he's also been for progress and growth. He's 65 years of age this month, but he's a young man's interest in the future and a young man's hope for his country. For he's lived with change, and he has sought to channel its force instead of combating it. He understands, as any Texan does, the meaning and importance of growth, for he has served one of the fastest growing countries and states and cities in the nation. And those who oppose progress should look at Houston and look at Texas. When he went to the United States Congress in 1936, some 27 years ago this month, this city had less than 200,000 people. But Albert Thomas had a vision of a modern Houston, which now has 1 million people and is growing stronger every day. He was not satisfied, nor the people of this city, with a channel which carried less than 30 million tons a year. He foresaw that this city, despite the fact it's located 50 miles from the sea, and I come from a city that is on the sea, and yet this city today ships second to the city of New York around the world. And that's in part because of Albert Thomas. And he and you were not content with an airport serving a handful of passengers and an industry of less than 300 planes, carrying passengers of less than 500 million revenue miles. He foresaw that that industry would provide 6 times as many planes, employ 19 times as many people, and serve more than 33 billion passenger miles a year. Here in Houston, the number of passengers who go through your great international airport have quadrupled in the last 15 years. This city's look forward with hope and commitment. And those who say no in Houston or in Texas or in the United States are on the wrong side in 1963. Finally, when Congressman Thomas went to the House of Representatives in 1936, he did not confine his sight to a Texas of less than 6 million people, a Texas doing less than $500 million of manufacturing, a Texas in which 37% of its population lived on the farm. By 1963, that population had dropped to 7%. The population of this state exceeds 10 million. The value of your manufacturing has climbed to $6 billion. And Texas today is one of the 10 most highly industrialized states in the Union. Many of the products and employers of this city and state were wholly unknown when Albert Thomas went to the House. Electronic machinery, sophisticated instruments, and preparations for the exploration of space. But those are the industries which helped this state reach its highest peak of prosperity in 1962, except for 1 year, 1963. In Texas and the nation, change has been the law of life. Growth has meant new opportunities for this state. Progress has meant new achievements. And men such as Albert Thomas, who recognized the value of growth and progress, have enabled this city and this state to rise with the tides of change instead of being swept aside and left behind. There were in 1936, as there are today, those who are opposed to growth and change, who prefer to defy them, who look back instead of forward. But Albert Thomas and those who work with him did not heed that view in the mid-30s. And this city, this state, and this country are glad that they did not. And we dare not look back now. If 27 years from now, in the year 1990, a new generation of Americans is to say that we too look forward, In 1990, for example, this nation will need three times as much electric power as it has today, four times as much water. And that's why we're developing the Canadian River and the San Angelo and the Columbus Bend and other Texas River projects, and seeking at Freeport to find an economical way to get fresh water from salt, and building anti-pollution plants throughout this state and nation in a new and expanded program. In 1990, the need for national and state parks and recreation areas will triple, reaching a total very nearly the size of Indiana. And that's why we're creating Padre Island Seashore and adding refuge. In 1990, your sons, daughters, grandsons, and grandchildren will be applying to the colleges of this state in a number three times what they do today. Our airports will serve five times as many passenger miles. We will need housing for 100 million more people, and many times more doctors and engineers and technicians than we are presently producing. That is why we're trying to do more in these areas. As in the 30s, Albert Thomas and Franklin Roosevelt and others did those things which make it possible for not only Texas, but the entire United States to prosper and grow as we do in the 1960s. In 1990, the age of space will be entering its second phase, and our hopes in it to preserve the peace, to make sure that in this great new sea, as on Earth, the United States is second to none. And that's why I salute Albert Thomas and those Texans who you sent to Washington in his time and since then, who recognized the needs and the trends today in the 60s, so that when some meet here in 1990, they will look back on what we did and say that we made the right and wise decisions. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions, the Bible tells us. And where there is no vision, the people perish. Albert Thomas is old enough to dream dreams and young enough to see visions. He sees an America of the future in the lifetime of us all, with 300 million people living in this country with a $2 trillion economy, which will happen in this century. Even more important, he sees in America, as do we all, strong in science and in space, in health and in learning, in the respect of its neighbors and all nations, an America that is both powerful and peaceful, with a people that are both prosperous and just. With that vision, we shall not perish, and we cannot fail. Behind the speaker's desk in the House of Representatives, there are words from a great speech by a great citizen of my state, Senator Daniel Webster. It said, "Let us develop the resources of our land, call forth its industry, develop its resources, and see whether we also, in our time and generation, may not perform something worthy to be remembered." Albert Thomas didn't need to read those words. He has performed something worthy to be remembered. Thank you.
Up from Houston into a star-lighted night, the presidential jet roared toward Fort Worth with its happy occupants. Shortly before midnight, November 21st, 1963, the air entourage landed at Fort Worth and greeted more crowds. The first half of the last 24 hours had been a tremendous success.